Okay, hello everyone. Welcome to Computer Science E7. I'm sorry for the room change, but in the past week we had an explosion in enrollment and I got a nervous call from the registrar earlier today saying, oh no, we have to move you out of that room because it's a fire hazard, or what I presumed was a fire hazard because we had definitely maxed out the space in that room. So here we are, for better or for worse, in Emerson 108, and hopefully everybody has made their way over here. So today is lecture 2, software tools. And today really is going to be a day of catch-up, so to speak, where we're going to introduce you to a lot of things about digital cameras in general, such as very generally how to download photos onto your computer, how to crop resizing, what resizing and cropping mean and do, and introducing you to Photoshop as well, which we will actually be using, especially in the latter half of the course. Now, I'm sure many of you have done some subset of all of those things, but the point here is that I want to make sure everybody is on the same level before we begin and dive into the course, especially now that assignment 1 is out. I want to be sure that there's nobody left behind who may be familiar with film cameras and how to develop photographs, but maybe not so familiar with how to capture photos taken on a digital camera, record them on the computer, and submit them to us for grading. So next week, though, don't be fooled, certainly, by any of the content that we go over this week. Next week, we really dive into some of the nitty-gritty and when we start talking about light and exposure. Okay, some other details. This is the Panasonic Lumix camera that we have available from the Church Street Lab for you to rent. I mentioned last week that we have 8 of them, and we do actually have to share these cameras with another course, a photojournalistic course offered in, via some other department. So as a result, you can rent them, but most likely you'll only be able to rent it for 24 hours at a time. So this is good in the sense that students in the other course can't take all 8 and then we're stuck for a week or more, but bad because you do have to take a number of photographs throughout this course, and if you don't have a camera, it admittedly may become a little bit inconvenient. Yes?
Apparently you don't have to pay.
That's right. You do not have to pay to rent these cameras. As long as you are registered in the course, credit or non-credit, you are able to take this out for free. You may have to give some collateral like your ID, or your Harvard ID, or something like that, but it should be okay for the most part. I am trying to bump up the rental time to 48 hours from 24, but they didn't let me do it last year, so I'm not too confident about that. So stay tuned about that. If that changes, I'll certainly let you know. But for now, these are the cameras that you may use. Note that, I'll talk about the assignment in a little bit, but note that you don't actually need to use this camera. If you have another digital camera, you can use that camera of yours, no matter what kind it is, to accomplish most of the assignment. There is one question, though, where you're required to submit about 16 photographs where you will need this camera if yours does not meet the requirements, and we'll talk about that in just a second. So last week we gave out a sectioning form and asked you all to fill it out, and we have a tentative list of schedules. Tuesdays, so tomorrow and Thursday. Note that this schedule only applies for this week for now. So we have the first section tomorrow in 53 Church Street. Note that the 2 days actually have different rooms, so don't get confused. Tomorrow is 53 Church Street, room 123, and Thursday's is 125. Now, due to some scheduling changes among the staff and also the increase in enrollments, we figured that it would be good that to actually retry some of this sectioning. So what will most likely happen is that I will post something on the forum and email all of you asking you to choose from a list of sections for you to decide which ones are best. The section list will be expanded, so specifically now we're thinking of offering perhaps a Monday 5:30 to 7:30 section, which might be more convenient for those of you coming from off campus. There will be more details on the forum when I post it, but just realize that if you don't respond to this question that we have for you, then your vote is, well, you won't have a vote. So please do respond to it so that we know what sections to create for you. Are there any questions on that? So this, for now, this is also on the course website, but for now, this only applies to this week, and we will have hopefully a more permanent schedule of sections available next week. Okay, so I mentioned the forum, and last week I talked a little bit about it and introduced it, but one of the things that I neglected to mention is that, there are a couple of important things that I neglected to mention. First of all, you should have received from us via email a username and password for you to log into the forum. So if you're registered for the course, you should have received login credentials for it. If you have not, for whatever reason, first check your junk mailbox just to make sure that it's not in there. If it's not in there, approach myself, John, or Chris, or email us at staff@csc7.org so that we can give you a username and password. This is vital. It's important that you have this because you will be required to use the forum for assignment one. So the sooner you get this done, the better, because then you can begin to work on your assignment. Notice that this isn't so much for those of you registered in the class, but those of us following from home can actually register for an account. It has different privileges than an E7 student does, but it's essentially the same thing. And when I say that other people can join, I mean that if you haven't noticed, last week we actually videotaped these lectures and posted them on the course website. This will hopefully encourage you to rewatch the lectures if need be, or even if you have some friends that you think might be interested in one or two lectures, then certainly feel free to pass it along to them. They are free for people to watch. And hopefully this room won't become too empty because all of you will decide to watch the videos instead. But just realize that it will take us a few days to put up the videos on the course website. So especially when assignment due dates are creeping up, you probably want to come to lecture just to make sure that you get all of the information as quickly as possible. So the assignment, it's passed out. If you don't have a copy, you can find it on the course website. We also have some up here, and I believe on the table back there. Basically, there are three parts. First part is relatively easy. You just have to find a photo that you like a lot. Perhaps you know of one already that you really, really enjoy. And you're just all you need to do is post it onto the course forum and tell us why you like it, and you'll be telling everybody really why you like it, why it's interesting, and you'll have an opportunity to critique. Part two is more of a problem set style section where it's more theory based questions. There's a little bit of math, but don't get too worried about it. Don't get too nervous. It's all very, very doable. Trust me. Many of these questions actually come from an exam from last year. And so if you think it's bad that it's on an assignment, just imagine what it would be like to not use a calculator or notes or anything on an exam. So that is hopefully a plus for you. Part three is a section where basically just have to take many photographs. So we require you to submit exactly a certain number of photographs. For question one, or rather for question 10, it's 18. For question 11, it's 16. However, this doesn't mean that you should only take 18 and 16 photographs. We certainly expect you to take many more than that and pick the best ones that you have taken. And indeed, as the semester goes along, you'll perhaps find yourself more critical of your own work, and you may soon find that you have to take many more in order to pick some of your favorite ones. But it's certainly very frustrating when you take 100 or 200 photographs and there's only one that you really like. Hopefully it won't be that bad so that you have to take, you know, 1,800 photographs, but certainly for this question 10, it should not be that difficult. So this question 10, this is what I was alluding to earlier. You can use your own camera, no matter what kind it is, and submit just photos that you take on a typical daily basis. Maybe not daily, maybe you're a weekend warrior with this, but certainly just take photos of everyday things. And we will actually revisit some of the subjects in these photographs at a later date, so be sure that you can go back to that location where you took the photograph, or that you can have that same subject in your photograph. And try to make them unique, please. It really would be, though I'm sure you love your cat, we really don't want to see 18 photographs from different angles of your cat. Question 11, that one will require the use of a camera that has a manual mode, and we will talk more about manual modes in upcoming lectures. But if you don't have, so if you don't have a camera that allows you to use manual mode, and feel free to email us as well for clarification, you'll probably have to rent one from the from 53 Church Street. Okay, any questions before we move on? Yes?
When you say that we need to be able to return to the subject,
yes.
Does it have to be the actual same people? Like, for example, let's say I like to go to Boston Common.
So,
would
okay.
it have to be actually the same people?
Right, no, no, no.
Or could I just go back to the Frog Pond?
No, of course, if you go to a location to take some photographs, such as Frog Pond or Boston Common in general, you're not expected to recreate the scene exactly.
So I don't have to recruit.
Right, no, exactly. Don't get models or actors or anything like that. You will basically be reinterpreting some of these photographs at a later date. So if you do decide to take one, for example, of your child or of your cat or of your pet, you don't have to reposition him, her, or them in the same exact spot to take the photograph. It's as long as it's the same subject. The idea is that you will be able to modify how you would have taken that photograph. So now you're taking a photograph in a certain way, and we want to look at the progression in the future about how you have adapted or how you change how you take photographs, if that makes sense. So just to have the same sort of thing, and so we say that at least six of the photographs are subjects or locations that you can reshoot in the future. That's not a terribly hard number. Don't worry if you take exactly six and, you know, in a few months, Frog Pond mysteriously disappears or something like that. And so you can't take that location. It's really not going to be that big of a deal. The idea is just it's just the general idea that's important here. Good question, though. Okay. Software tools. So there are many, many different types of classes of software tools. And in fact, there seems to be a large confusion, particularly about Photoshop and another product that Adobe creates called Lightroom. And many people believe that they are meant to compete with each other in a certain way, but they really just belong to different classes of software. And so I'm sure there are many others, but some of the ones that I was able to come up with are there are photo organizers, such as Aperture falls into one of them. Lightroom is another example of software that can help you organize your photographs. Then you have raw processing products such as, again, Aperture. You have Phase One, Capture One products, Bibble Pro, a number of other things that are meant perhaps to take a raw photograph out of your camera and process it for you to export to the web or to an email, for example. Then there's also image manipulation and retouching. So this is really where Photoshop falls, where it's very, very powerful software where you can manipulate an image that you import into it with perhaps not a lot of ease, but with a lot of features and a lot of power. And of course, many of these different types of software actually overlap. So Aperture, for example, and Lightroom are both organizers and raw processors. It helps you, it puts both of those things into one. But I would argue that neither of these software packages are very good image manipulators. Sure, you can do some image manipulation, but if you really want to get to some powerful stuff, you have to move to some dedicated software such as Photoshop or some other piece of software. So if you have one of these pieces of software and not the other, and you may be saying, well, I really don't need to purchase more than one, you certainly don't have to for the course, but may realize that after a while you do need more than one piece of software in your workflow in order to accomplish certain tasks. And so I was talking a bit about raw processors, and we'll talk a lot more about raw files and raw the raw file format that comes out of a camera at a future date. But for now, you just have to imagine it as essentially what it sounds like. It's basically just capturing the raw data that comes off of the camera, doesn't convert it to a JPEG like many cameras do, and then gives it to your computer for processing. So we'll talk much more about this later. So it seems worthwhile now to mention some ways of organizing your photos. And there's certainly many, many ways of doing it, and I'm sure almost all of you have unique or different ways of organizing your photographs. But perhaps the simplest way, or at least the most basic way of doing it, is just to organize them into different folders. So you may not have it organized such as this, where I have one folder for different images, But you may have a folder for trips, for example, or you may have a folder for each specific event that you have taken a photograph for. And so there's some obvious advantages and disadvantages to this. First of all, it's relatively easy to maintain. You know how you've set this up. You can create more folders as you want, and you can maintain your hierarchy and your organization as you want. There's really there's nothing keeping you from changing your hierarchy or your organization. It's also very portable, which means that when you get a new computer, you don't have to worry about moving software, specialized software, to that new computer. You can just copy over all of those folders and files, and all of that hierarchy still exists on that new computer. So I mentioned that you don't need to move over specialized software. So another thing is cost. It's very, very cheap. You just need a computer that has folder support, which is just about all of them these days, for you to be able to do this. There's no software required. It's cheap. There seems like there's a lot of advantages. The problem with this, and certainly I did this at first when I first started doing digital photography, was that it gets messy very, very quickly. Any little thing, if you're not very, very strict about your organization, you can start mixing files together. You can put a whole bunch into one folder that you really didn't intend to, and it can become quite a big mess very, very fast. And it can also be difficult to find specific images. So especially if you don't rename these images after they come out of the camera, then you may not know, well, what the hell is image 9491? I certainly don't know, and this is part of my organization, or it was part of my organization. So you'd have to open every one in order to figure out what it is. So, okay, these disadvantages seem pretty major to me, and it's something that I really don't want to have to deal with. So let's try using some specialized software. So after I was attempting to use just straight folders, I went to some other software called iView Media Pro. And actually this software has quite a long history, and I think a few years ago, the company was bought out by Microsoft, and it may be actually named something else. I'm not really sure. I haven't really followed along with this, but it actually was really nice, because I then had the ability to add or to tag specific images with some specific sets of data. So it's probably a little bit difficult to read from afar, but you can see thumbnails from all of these images. You can see that there's a list of data that's given to the left of the images, so that I can quickly find some specific photo that I was looking for. And the way that this would work was it actually ended up becoming very, very cumbersome, because I would connect a camera to my computer, download all of the images, put them all into here, and would have to organize them with all of these tags and sets of data that would differentiate it from other sets of photos. And at the time, this software, though it was very, very powerful, it also was sort of basic in the fact that the default view was that all images would be presented at once. So all 10,000, 20,000 of your photos would be presented in this one window, and it becomes really difficult to have to scroll to find the image that you want. So we've come quite a long way since then. Lightroom is a terrific example of some software that can help you organize it, but I use Aperture, which is Apple's competing product to Adobe's Lightroom, and there are certainly advantages and disadvantages to both that I certainly couldn't enumerate all of them and won't get into, but I find using this software to be much better. And it certainly, sure, it has some disadvantages, but it certainly is better than using these flat files or to use this folder hierarchy from before, and using this sort of flat, all of my photos are suddenly being exposed to me all at once idea that was presented in iView Media Pro. And so you can probably see just the basic layout of Aperture, and there's some folders along the left side that you can't really read them, but just trust that it's part of the organization. Then you can see a list. I have selected one folder, and you can see a list of photographs that exist in that folder, so that you can use events, for example. You can put all of your photos from one event into one folder, and then you can see only those photos in that event. And then you can select one photo or one or more photos to look at in a higher resolution. And so this seems to be generally pretty good, at least for the way that I like to work with it. One of the things about having to use lots and lots of metadata was that I find myself having to really micromanage the photos when I had to tag all of them with metadata. And if you're not familiar with metadata, it's basically just an extra set of data that can help describe a photograph. So keyword, for example, you might associate certain keywords with photographs. So this one that's selected here, you could name it a series of things, portraiture, group photographs. But then you can really get into some of the nitty-gritty stuff, such as red dress. You could count the number of people. You can list who the people are if you really wanted to be sure that you could find it later. And having to do all of that becomes really, really problematic. And that's actually what I ended up doing, was I really tried to put as much detail into it as I possibly can. And by the end, I had literally more keywords than I had photos, which makes it sort of impossible to find what it is I'm looking for. So I've moved to Aperture, and I've used this separate scheme. And now I'm sure there are those of you that could pick apart this hierarchy and say, well, what about this corner case? What about this corner case? But I find that this works very, very well for me. And this is presented to you not as a do it this way or else you will fail this class. This is really meant as an idea for you. If you are having trouble organizing your photos, maybe you can try something like this hierarchy. So you notice that we have, again, the concept of folders in Aperture. And so it seems sort of silly to have to use specific folders rather than a file folder that's actually in the file system. But Aperture provides so many other advantages when processing these photos that it just seemed natural to have to use it. So you can notice that at the very top, it's the library. And I rarely use this. When you click on it, it basically shows you all of the photographs in a similar style to this iView Media Pro. It'll show you all your tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of photographs right there, right in front of you. So I don't use that library too much, but it's there because it's your entire library of photos. Then it has this concept of smart albums, or where you can define certain sets of metadata will flag a photo, and those flagged photos will be put into this album. So for example, 4-star or better. So here, you can rate photographs, and I'll show you an example of that in just a second. You can rate photographs, and so 4 stars or 5 stars will then be placed into this 4-star or better album, which makes it pretty easy to find photos that I'd like. If I flagged it that high, then I probably like that photograph. There's some other ones, but the folders that we want to look at are jobs, so any specific jobs that I've had to take. So if I've been contracted to capture an event, I will create an album in this jobs folder and put all of the photos in there. Personal, that's stuff like pictures of my car, pictures of my pets, of my girlfriend, for example, where it really doesn't fall into any other category, but it's just a photo for me or for my friends. Places, this is things, so you'll notice that there's places and trips, and there's an important distinction. Trips are something like vacations. So if I go on a trip to somewhere relatively exotic, even if it's somewhere like New Hampshire that I don't go to frequently, that would be a trip in my mind. But a place is somewhere that I frequent a lot. So it's perhaps my home. It's perhaps New York, which I go to very frequently. It might be certain neighborhoods around Boston, Cambridge, where all of these places would fall into places rather than a trip. Things and projects, so these are, it's sort of like jobs, except it's a job for myself. So if I have any camera tests that I want to do or some sort of project that I want to do with photography or with photographs, I'll tend to put it into things and projects. Then, of course, trips is self-explanatory. Any vacations or stuff that I, or any trips that I take, you know, just sort of special trips. And then work, so stuff like stuff like this class for E7. I'll have a folder in there for E7 to place all of my photographs. Any other work-related things. So there's a whole variety of things you can do, but I find that by doing it this way, when I remember that I had taken a photo, I usually remember where I had taken it or in what context. And this way, it makes it a lot easier for me to find it without having to tag the photos with a lot of metadata. And so we actually have this idea of ratings in Aperture, and I'm sure in many other organizational tools as well, and stacks. And so first ratings, you can rate a photograph based on how much you like or dislike it. So you can give it any amount from 0 to 5 stars, and then you can go back and just take a look. You can start to refine your list of photographs from some particular event until you get to maybe you've narrowed down your list of 200 images down to 5 or 6 4 or 5 star images that you really want to look at and you want to work on. Stacks is a pretty interesting feature where you can combine multiple images that are very, very similar. So perhaps you are taking a photograph of one thing or one subject and you're trying multiple times. You can place all of those photographs into one stack. And so collapse that stack and you can be able to look at, you can expand that stack and look at individual photographs. And so we can see an example of a stack at this, these bottom two photographs. If you take a look, let's see if I can do this, zoom in a little bit, you'll see that the two images are actually very similar. In fact, one is just a second version of the other. And so in this way, I've put them into one stack so that when I'm looking at all of these photographs, I don't really have to look at all of the similar photographs as well. I can look at only the unique ones, or the ones that I consider unique. And so Aperture has some pretty funky stuff where it'll try to automatically stack photos based on the length of time that it's been between the photos and various things. But I don't really trust those features. I found it kind of gimmicky and it didn't work very well for me. And so stacking these things by default, or not by default, manually tended to work the best. And so I mentioned earlier that we have this concept of metadata or keywords. And you can see this is just the subset of the list. I really hadn't bothered to... Okay, so you can see that this is a list of keywords in my Aperture library. And you notice that there's one section called iView Media Pro. And if I were to expand that section, it actually would crash my computer because I had, like I mentioned, tens of thousands of keywords that just were meaningless, ended up being meaningless. And so surprisingly enough, I use keywords relatively infrequently. Even though I tried my best, I now find that this organization that I have found recently to be sufficient for what I need to do. However, keywords do have their use. You can tag a photograph with keywords such as for people or for particular places or for particular things that might be common, and then you can go back and find each of these photographs based on a keyword just by searching for that keyword. Metadata. So we have a variety of metadata available to us, and a lot of this may or may not make sense, but eventually as we continue on through the course, a lot of this will end up making sense. And you can see that this gives us a lot of the information about the photograph when we had taken the photograph. And so you may recognize that some of this data, when I demoed the forum last week, is also represented when you upload a photograph to the forum. So this might imply, so you can imagine that there is some place in the photograph where this data is stored. And it's called EXIF. There's a variety of other metadata types as well, but the most popular one in photography is EXIF. And EXIF data stores a lot of this metadata regarding the photograph itself. So it will tell us a lot about the exposures. So, for example, what camera was used to take this photograph? It was a Canon 20D, my camera here. It tells you the aperture, the shutter speed, exposure bias, the focal length, if it's available, and a variety of other things. And they actually have a fairly large, there's actually a consortium that deal with this sort of thing. And if you wanted to look and find each of the, specifications. So in exif.org, it's sort of the unofficial website for this EXIF specification. But you can take a look at some of these specifications, such as EXIF 2.1. You can see that it really contains a lot of data that you could really go crazy with. I really am not going to bore you by going through all of this, but trust me, there's a lot of stuff here. And it can store a variety of things. So like I mentioned, there's EXIF that allows the camera to store specific information about the image. Then there's other types of metadata as well. Another one that you will commonly see is IPTC. And this is the metadata where you will store a lot of your keywords. You might store some copyright information in this separate metadata. And so all of this metadata is saved in the file of your photograph. So in that photographic file that you had, it will be stored in there. And so you can actually read so you can read EXIF data yourself with a variety of utilities. And let's see, we can do this here. So I have a photo. This is the same photo that I'm sure has been posted everywhere. This is that sunset photo. If I go into the information, we can actually look at, can we? Okay. That is strange. All right, well, rest assured that normally, just about every other time that I do this, you can click on the info and find all of this information that is actually embedded within the image. And so it's just another reason why live demos are not a good thing, because they always fail and they fail embarrassingly frequently. Okay, so, all right. So we will look at EXIF in the future, especially as a lot of this data becomes more relevant to you and more interesting to us. But for now, this is actually how we determine a lot of the specifications for this assignment. So you'll notice if you've read through the assignment that we require that you take the image specifically for this assignment. And we know that you've done that if the EXIF data has the proper date in it, for example. It has a date of when we posted, from between when we posted the assignment and before the due date. And then there's a variety of other things, such as the mode that the camera used. We know which mode you used to take the photograph, if it was manual mode, if it wasn't manual mode. All of this data is embedded into the photograph. And when you save photographs, some pieces of software will actually remove this metadata. It really depends on what type of software you're using, what sort of settings you're using when you're saving a photograph. Photoshop can even remove a lot of this metadata if you ask it to. So you must be very, very careful. So this is why we ask you to submit to us unmodified images, because then that way we know that you have not opened up the file and saved it somehow, and perhaps all of that metadata is now gone because of whatever. Perhaps the software wasn't written for it, or perhaps you either accidentally or intentionally chose not to include the EXIF. So it's important that you send us these JPEG files straight out of the camera. And actually, if I can mention something else, I'm sure many of you are actually familiar with RAW files and perhaps take photographs on your camera using in the RAW format. Realize that we require that you submit JPEGs only. Do not take a RAW photograph and then process it and then send it to us. We really want the JPEGs to come straight out of the camera. Many cameras, though, fortunately, have this mode where you can take both RAW photos and JPEG photos at the same time, and it'll save both files onto the memory card. You can download both, and you can do whatever you want with the RAW file, but you can send to us the JPEG file that you took. So be sure that you change your settings now, or at least before you start taking the photographs for this, because we really, really is important that you send JPEG files to us. Okay, so back to metadata after that short tangent. So good software will interpret all of this data for you. So just like Aperture has done for me here, it actually shows me all of this data in a very easy to read format. However, if you were to look at the raw metadata as it comes out of the file, it's actually quite a mess. So, for example, the shutter speed, I think they actually write down the shutter speed, but not in a fraction. It's in decimal form. So 1/2500th of a second would be whatever it is. All right, let's see. Another live demo that's going to go amok. Would actually be stored as 0.0004 seconds. And so this may not be very interesting, especially if you're used to looking at shutter speeds in a particular way. So this software has to be able to interpret and redefine, re-enable. Why can't I think of a proper word here? So it will actually display all of this data in the format that you expect. Okay. So I mentioned before that there are other ways to organize photographs, and this actually is a question I want to pose for you. So I gave my way of organizing. Do any of you have perhaps a better way, a way that can organize that you use to organize your photos that is perhaps more efficient or is somehow better in any way, certainly do speak up, because I'm certainly curious to know. Yes?
There's not a better way, but you haven't mentioned iPhoto, which comes with, for those Mac users, it comes embedded and you don't need to purchase any application. Do you recommend not using iPhoto for?
Oh, okay. So iPhoto, yeah. So iPhoto is actually wonderful organization software that comes with Macs. And if you buy a modern Mac, they always come with iPhoto. And it's free software that you can use to download images to your computer, and it will help you organize it. And especially the most recent version of iPhoto that was released, that is actually, I think, a pay upgrade if you have an older version of iPhoto, it actually will help you detect the faces in a photo, for example, and it will actually be able to, if you tag a couple of your images as being one of your friends, then it will try to go through all of your images and tag all of the photos that has your friend in it. So it can certainly be a very useful organizational tool, but it really is somewhat basic in that its power lies with organization and with processing of JPEG files. It's not terrific software for raw processing, for example. So it's very good as an organizational tool, but I found it somewhat limiting in that respect. And so certainly, if you are a casual photographer and you take most of your photos in JPEG format, then iPhoto is the way to go. Don't spend the $100-$200 that it costs to buy Aperture or Lightroom. However, if you take your photos, if you take mostly raw photos, you'll most likely need a beefier package, such as Aperture or Lightroom, to be able to organize and process your photos in one go. So I certainly don't not recommend iPhoto. It's wonderful software, and it's great if you have a Mac and you can use it. But certainly after a while, in this course, when we start moving to raw photos, it may start to appear somewhat limiting. Yes? Capture NX. So I believe the major manufacturers like Canon and Nikon have some pay software that can be used to organize and process your photos. I tried to use the one, so I don't have any experience with the Nikon one, so I really can't give a thumbs up or thumbs down, but I tried to use the one from Canon for a little while. And I found it slow and cumbersome, and it was more of, it just seems more of an afterthought than these other packages that were designed that are more general, perhaps, that are more adaptable for all sorts of cameras, but were designed from the ground up to really be speedy and to be good organizational tools. And so that's just my experience with the Canon one. I do, though, advocate the use of some of the specific software. Most of these SLR cameras do come with their own CDs with some software, and they have some capabilities that these much more expensive packages don't have. Especially when we're talking about tethering, which we'll get to in just a little bit. But the buying of a package as an organizational tool from one of these camera manufacturers, I'm not sure I necessarily recommend. Certainly the best way to determine which one is best for you is to try a demo of all of these different types of software. If you can download a demo from Nikon or Canon about their software, then do it and just give it a shot and see what it's like. I know you can download demos for Lightroom and try them out just to see if it matches your style. Aperture, I don't know if there's a demo because I've had it for so long now, but certainly we have so many Apple stores around here that you can go to one and almost every computer has it. You can try it in the store with, they have some demo albums and photographs there already so that you can try and compare it from Lightroom to iPhoto to Aperture to all of these various other organizational tools that I haven't even mentioned and just find out which one is best for you. Certainly don't buy Aperture just because I like it and because I use it. Look for the one that's best for you and get that one instead. Yes.
Okay, other organizational methods. It's not better, but it's a lot quicker.
Quicker, okay.
Just do it by date. Like Earfun View seems to do that as their default.
By date, okay. Yeah,
and then at a later point, you can say, oh, yeah, that was my trip, and that was the Christmas party and things like that.
Right. So yeah. So organizing your photos by date is a great way to do it as well. And I think certainly I know that iPhoto at least and some other software will show you, will organize it for you by date, and that you can then go back and tag each of these images as a separate trip, for example. I think one trick that iPhoto does is every time you download a set of photographs from your camera, it sets that as a separate roll, so this concept of film rolls, and then that way you can call that roll something specific. And that's certainly an interesting way of organizing it as well. It's an interesting initial pass at organizing this data, but I found that what happens many times is that you can go for a long time before downloading some of these photographs to your computer, and the roll then will have many events all in one go. Yeah, certainly date is a wonderful way to do it. Yes?
I have a question, actually.
Sure.
If one of your main goals is to share your photos like online, do you have a recommendation for keeping things? Like I use Flickr, but only because it's reasonably easy and inexpensive. Do you have any recommendations on that?
So in terms of sharing photos online?
Yeah, keeping them organized and not wanting to use your computer as your main source of organization, but something online.
So so using online tools for organization is, I tend to stay away from that just because Flickr, for example, well, in almost all cases, you have some sort of limit about how many photos you can upload or how many photos per month you can upload. And certainly if you take a lot of photographs, it can become expensive or time-consuming at the very least to upload maybe 50, 100 photos every day or every couple of hours to one of these sites for organization. I find that doing it locally on your computer tends to be quicker. And then once you've selected the images that you like out of those, then post those online and organize those. And I'm sure there's definitely a way that you can select the best images or what you consider your best images, post them online, and then organize them online. But the other disadvantage to that, I would say, is that you are placing the trust of your photos in someone else's hands. So what if, for some reason, Flickr loses its organization or the files that it uses to remember the organization, and suddenly you are now sort of stuck with just this flat set of files? And not, of course, there's an argument that could be made that you are more likely to lose that data locally, but that actually is a pretty good segue to what I wanted to recommend about backup. And I cannot stress backup enough. I go crazy with backup. So just a little anecdote. When I was using iView Media Pro, I was also backing up my hard drive to an external hard drive. And this was good because I had a laptop, and it was the only computer that I had. And I was putting all of my photos on the laptop. And I was worried, well, what if one day I drop my laptop and my hard drive dies, for example? I would lose all of the photos. So I had an external drive, which now you can buy for really dirt cheap, very, very cheap hard drives. And I saved all of my photos on that external drive as well. And well, one day the hard drive in my laptop died, and I was, you know, very upset because I had homework and all sorts of stuff that I needed to recover. So I went to my backup drive, but I hadn't checked my backup drive in a while, and it had also died as well. So just because I had a backup doesn't mean that I was actually able to recover. So luckily, I was able to recover almost all. It was like 99, 98% of the photographs after a lot of stress and tearing out my hair and missing some important assignments. But it's this. So now I sort of overcompensate, and it would be embarrassing to say how many hard drives I have now to back it up. So I'll tell you. So I have on my computer, so I have this laptop, obviously, but at home I have a Mac Pro, which is a desktop machine, and it can have four hard drives inside of it. So I have one hard drive that's the main hard drive. It stores all of my photos. Then I have a backup of that hard drive, and then that backup I mirror onto two other drives. So one of those drives, so three of these drives are actually in the computer. Then I have another hard drive that's outside, an external drive, that I disconnect from the computer and from the electrical outlet just in case there's some crazy spike and I lose all my hard drives. So I have th- 3 or 4, I can't even remember. It's at least 3 backups of all of this data, just because I'm so paranoid now that one experience was enough to just drive me crazy, and I back everything up. Yes. That's, I know, offsite. The idea that I had with this external drive was that I would actually put it in my car, in the trunk of my car. But the thing was that I was waiting to get a little bit more money so that I could have 2 external drives, so that I could have one in my car and one unplugged in the house at all times, and then every couple of days I could swap them. But this was getting really cumbersome and expensive, so I said, forget it. But the problem is that I have a lot of RAW files. All of the photos that I take are in RAW format, and when it's 10 megabytes each, it can become very expensive to put it online. So Amazon has, for example, its EC2 service, or its, what's the storage one called? Can somebody help me? The cloud, yeah, they have various cloud services where you can actually store data. You can rent from them for so many pennies a month, all of the data. And I did the math, and it would be essentially the cost of a hard drive every month for me to do it. And so right now I'm sort of taking my chances. knock on wood, though I'm losing my words today. It's the room. I miss Harvard Hall. Yes, superstitious. I'm not a very superstitious person, but about backups, I very much am superstitious, so I must knock on wood. Yes?
I actually have had a house fire.
Really?
And I did, I was able to recover my stuff off my laptop, but since then I've actually bought a small fireproof safe, and that's very much.
A small fireproof safe? That's a good idea, actually. Yeah. That's excellent. Huh.
They're not that expensive.
I always wonder how much those actually work, though. Like, how is there some sort of temperature where they just start to fail? Or do they become so hot inside that I would melt the hard drive and then open it up and be like, yeah, I have a fireproof hard drive, and then I open it up, it's all melted.
Fire, though, it's the water. The water is what gets you.
The water, that's true.
I have.
Interesting. Well, I have not had a house fire, so I am not that well versed. But it sounds like, from your experience, you can. We'll have to talk about the various ways and come up with a bulletproof E7 way of backing up your files. Unfortunately, I'm sure there's no way. You'd have to store your files in all places of the earth to protect it from like asteroids hitting and destroying an entire continent and that sort of thing. So, at what point do you really want to make sure that your files are saved? And perhaps not 4 hard drives, but I would recommend at least 1 backup. In fact, if I could, I would require it, but I can't, so I can only beg you to please back up your data. I have a picture here of a 500 gigabyte hard drive. These are probably pennies now. Well, I'm exaggerating, I'm sure, but you can find external drives for quite cheap. You'll be stimulating the economy, so think of it as doubly beneficial to back up all of your data. I think I saw a hand for a question. Yes?
And have you considered just saving the best photographs and not saving every single one?
Yes. Have I considered saving my best photographs? So there are a variety of ways of backing up data. So one thing is saving the photographs themselves. The other way is perhaps printing out photographs that you like and using some sort of photo archive to have a
I meant the data.
No, I understand. I'm just sort of stepping through a variety of backup scenarios as well. Excuse me. But there are, yes, I have considered backing up just the best photographs or the most important ones onto maybe a CD or a DVD, for example, and putting those into some sort of safe area. But I had a good reason for not doing this, and now that I'm on the spot, I can't remember what it is. But I think for one thing, it can become, well, no, it's not an expensive thing. DVDs and CDs are pretty cheap now, so it's a great idea, certainly. I had a reason for not doing it, and unfortunately, it eludes me at this point, like just about all of my words at this point. But I'm sorry?
They lose data eventually.
That's true. They do lose data. Well, yeah, so CDs and DVDs do degrade over time, and certainly there are a variety of quality discs where some will last years and some will last maybe 10 or 20 years. But it really boils down to also being able to read that data in some future computer. Like now, for example, you'd be hard-pressed to be able to read data off of a 5 1/4-inch floppy, for those of you that remember those. It'd be very, very difficult to do that. You can make the same argument, of course, about external hard drives, where we will lose these ports that we currently use, USB and FireWire, to connect hard drives to newer and newer computers. But the idea, as long as you can keep on top of it and be able to move your data from your old computer to your new computer and do this ad nauseum, then you'll be able to protect your machine. And this is actually perhaps the biggest downside to digital photography, is that especially if you take raw photographs, they're proprietary file formats. They're not like JPEG, where it's very, very common and you can just fire up any old browser even to look at a JPEG file. But raw file formats require specialized software, such as Aperture or certain versions of macOS or a variety of other software that exists. And most likely, this software is not going to exist or will not be able to run on computers 10, 20 years from now. And so what then happens to our photographs? And so this is why this is one of the arguments for using film also, is that you can look at your negatives and you will always be able to, well, as long as the chemicals still exist, you'll always be able to develop those negatives. Or at least if you have the photosensitive paper, you'll be able to reprint the images if you have the negative. And there's been some movement now towards this standardized raw file format. I believe it's called DNG from digital negative, I think, is what it stands for. And I believe the process was led by Adobe, and there's probably some other companies that back it as well. And hopefully if I'm saying something wrong, someone will correct me. But the idea is that it is a standardized raw format so that it will become popular, much like JPEG, and that in the future we will have a greater chance or greater probability of being able to open our raw file format files in some future computer. Yes?
In the meantime, couldn't you use TIFF as the archival master?
I'm sorry?
In the meantime, failing that, couldn't you use
TIFF? You could use... Yes, certainly. So you could do... One of the things you could do is convert your raw file format to a different file format that's more standardized, such as TIFF. If you remember from the first lecture, we were talking about how TIFF files can actually have 48-bit color, 16-bit per color channel, and this means that you're able to save just about every bit of data that existed out of your raw file into a separate file. If you were really worried about that, that's certainly one way to go. Though one of the things about raw file formats is that they save a lot of proprietary information that would be lost in that conversion, and it's specifically camera-specific information. So my 20D might save specific bits of information that I don't have any specific ideas of right now, but it saves some information to the raw file, and if you just convert it to a TIFF, you would lose some of this information. And certainly, also, when you do the conversion, you have to process the raw file format. And every time you process it, you can argue that you are degrading the quality of the photograph. So you can never truly go back to the original. So, yes?
Just a note on the negatives, and you're saying that they're more long-lasting.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, one of the issues, you have similar issues with storing negatives. You do get fungus growth on negatives and on slides.
Right.
And, you know, digital, really, you don't have that problem. So...
Right, that's very true. That's very true. So to reiterate for the camera, the film also does have storage issues about, perhaps it fades or degrades or fungus can grow on it over time. And so you have to be very, very careful about how you store your slide film or your film negative as well. And so, I mean, it there certainly becomes a point where you just have to accept the fact that all of this stuff will become obsolete, and although you may love your photos for now, it will become difficult unless you work very hard to be able to maintain your collection many, many years from now, decades from now. Even if you archive them via print, so if you print out your favorite ones, you would have to be very, very careful about archiving those prints so that they don't fade on whatever photo paper you're using. And there is actually a website that exists where they show you, they actually rate the durability of photo printers, so printers that you can actually purchase, sit next to your computer, and print out your photos. They rate the photo printers and the photo paper that's available for them and tell you just which ones would be the longest lasting based on a variety of factors, such as how long will it last if you leave it near a window and sun is constantly hitting it? How long would it last if you keep it in a frame so that there's glass and you're UV protecting the photo, for example? And it's really quite a shock. Many of these photos, if you expose them to the elements, won't last longer than a year, maybe 2 years max. But if you take care of the photographs, they can usually last, well, assuming you do it correctly, they can last 10, 20 years in print format before they begin to degrade. And at that time, then, in the future, you could then go through and scan all of your photos, and then you have the same problem over again. And so it's just this sort of cyclic problem about how paranoid do you want to be about backing up your data? How paranoid do you want to be about making sure you can retrieve every last bit of information out of all of your photos 20 years from now? Because I can guarantee that you probably won't care very much about at least the majority of the photos that you take. Perhaps the ones that you really like, you'll care about, but most of them, I bet in the future, you may not care about so much. And so if I can go step out of that tangent and come back to the digital negative, this DNG file format from Adobe, they do actually have a free converter for many RAW file formats that exist today. And you can take, for example, your 20D format, your Nikon file format that's not very, very new, download this converter, run the RAW files through them, and you will have this digital negative. You can have this DNG file format where you can then take it to other Adobe products that can recognize this software. If you do that, I always recommend, though, that you keep whatever original file came out of your camera. Keep it and back it up as best as you can. So you can determine your own level of paranoia, but certainly if you keep the original, you can then go back to it and make sure that you can extract almost every bit out of it that you can. Okay, let's take a 5-minute break. So just to reiterate what I mentioned in the first lecture about them, so they're optional sections. They will be going over perhaps in more depth a lot of the material from lectures. So you might get a little bit of new material just in the sense that it will be perhaps more in-depth if possible on the lecture material. And it's a great opportunity for you to ask specific questions or just to socialize a little bit more with other students and with one of the TFs that will be leading the section. Certainly do bring your questions to the section because that will be a great place to ask them. Yes? We actually have not discussed an online section, so I would have to say no at this point. Unfortunately, there will only be, especially since this is not a distance course, we'll only have two sections. But that's why we are going to make a bigger mess of all of this and redo the sectioning form so that we can be absolutely sure, based on the new schedules that we have available to us, what will be the most convenient sections for people throughout the week.
The forum can be something of an online section.
Yes, that's a very good point. The forum is an excellent place to ask questions. So it won't be formally organized like an online section might be, where you can meet a TF from 5:30 to 7:30 or 6:30 to 8:30 at some specific time. But it is a great place to ask general questions about lecture, the assignment, variety of other things. That is a good point. Thank you. Okay. Any other questions before we move on? So let's see. I think I was on here. Okay. So let's see. So I actually have Aperture installed on this machine, and you'll notice that I actually don't have any photos on this laptop at all. It's very, very blank and very, very dull and boring at this point. So I figured I would just take a minute to very, very quickly just do an overview of steps about how to download photos to your computer. And this applies not only for Mac machines, but also Windows machines and just about any software that you use. So you need three things. You need a camera, you need a computer, and you need a USB cord. If you are renting a camera from the Church Street Lab, I mentioned this last week, but just be sure that you are given the USB cord that connects the camera to your computer. Also be sure not only that you, so you need three things from them. You need the camera, the USB cord, and the power adapter. So just be sure you have those things before you leave the lab. So you connect the camera to the computer, and there's really no other way to do it. You just connect the cable wherever it'll plug into either place. I guarantee it'll work. You turn on your camera, you turn on your computer, and you load up whatever software it is that you use. Almost all of the time, when you turn on your camera, after you connect it to the computer, some software will automatically come up and offer to download the software or offer to download the photos for you. Let's see, on Macs, I know it's called Image Capture, or you might use iPhoto, or you might even use Aperture. On Windows, I believe there's some sort of photo and scanning wizard, or it might be called something like that, that pops up when you plug in and turn on a camera. So just to give you an idea, I have right now a camera connected. I have created an album called E7, and I'm actually going to download a photo. So let's see. I am going to go to, so I selected import in this case, and where is my camera? Maybe it is not on. Live demos, every time it becomes embarrassing. Okay, here we go. So I turn it back on. You can see that I have a couple of photos here. And there's actually one photo that I want to show you that you all might be interested in, so I'm going to import all of them. Just about all software will have something similar. It'll might be called download all or import all or copy all, something like that. Just click that button. Make sure you save the photos somewhere where you know you'll be able to retrieve them later. Okay, so this is done. Now let's take a look at this photo here. This is the, yes, so this is the pinhole photo of the, whoops, so it's full screen on the other screen, but not this screen. Let me see. Let's see. I want to try to put the image on the, it's not going to let me do this, not quickly. So this is the pinhole photo, and you can notice a few things about it. One thing is that it is very blurry. Another thing is that it is very overexposed. And so we can actually do some adjustments to this, which at this point I'll just gloss over. But I'll just do something to make it look like I'm a really good photographer. I'll decrease the exposure a little bit. Let's see, increase the contrast a lot. So I will recommend that when you are editing some of your photographs, and if you're using something such as iPhoto or Photoshop Elements, for example, where you can do some basic modifications to your photographs at a lower price, some of the most interesting changes that you can make to a photograph to really increase how much it pops off the screen or how good it looks is to increase the contrast, but don't increase it too much, and increase the saturation. We'll talk more about all of this stuff as the various appropriate lectures come up, but now you can see that after a few adjustments of contrast and saturation, we are now able to make it appear as though it were a real photograph and that I am an awesome pinhole photographer. Yes?
Non-destructive edits?
Yes, so this, I actually took this photo using the RAW file format. Aperture does perform these edits non-destructively, so I can go back to the original unedited RAW format without any hassle. In fact, this is something that's very useful, and we'll talk more about this later, but when you have some editing software, it's very important that you do not actually, what's called destructively edit the photo that you've downloaded. So if you're not sure if your software is destructively editing or not, do my suggestion from last week where you actually copy the JPEGs or the RAW files that come off of your camera into two different locations. So you might have an original location, then you might have a separate location where you can edit them without worrying about whatever you do to those files. Just so long as you never touch those original files, you'll certainly be fine. However, when you're working with RAW files, it's a lot easier, I think, to perform non-destructive edits. And a destructive edit would be something such as increasing the contrast in this photograph too much so that we lose some information at either end of the exposure. And if this sounds a little bit over your head, don't worry, we'll talk more about this later. I really don't mean to be pushing all of this off, but there's only so much that we can do before talking about a lot of this stuff in detail. But anyway, so it is possible to lose some data at either end when you increase the contrast or saturation too much. And if you save that file, so if I saved this increased contrast and saturation over the old file, that is a destructive edit because I have lost some information and I am not able to regain it. Aperture, I'm sure many other RAW organizers and processors do this as well, but Aperture does something where it saves the original unmodified RAW file. Every change that you make is basically saved in like a text file where it then can reload what changes have been made and reapply them to the original RAW file. So in that way, you're just making modifications and it's just changing its appearance based on the instructions that you're telling it. But when you go back to the original file, you have not actually modified that original file. So that is, thank you for bringing up that point. That is an important distinction to make about destructive and non-destructive edits. Certainly do be very, very careful about that. Okay, so just to give you an idea of my general workflow, if this were on my home computer where I had all of those folders and albums set up, I would put this into an E7, maybe a pinhole album in my E7 folder in the work folder, for example. And then I would rate this photo. So because this is the only photo I took, I'd probably rate it fairly highly so that I could come back to it. I really dislike rating photos at 5, but so in this case, I'd probably do it for 4. I reserve photos with a high rating of 5 for those that I really think are truly, truly excellent. 4 is more of like I like this photo and I can do something with it or it's important to me, but it's not the best photo, one of the best photos that I've ever taken. And certainly, there's an argument that could be made that 5 stars is too much granularity when you're rating some of these photographs. I certainly don't care about photos that are 1 or 2 stars, and I caught myself for a while trying to decide, well, this photo is really blurry. Is it a 1 star or is it a 2 star? Like, why do I care? I don't care. So what I ended up doing was I would give it basically a rejection rating. You can give it a rejection rating, or I would give it 3 through 5 stars, because at that point, I mean, for some photos that I may want to keep for some sort of stylistic reason, I will rate 1 to 2. So, well, let me perhaps break it down a little bit better. So photographs that I rate 1 to 2 are photos that have something really wrong with them, where the subject is completely overexposed or very, very blurry due to some focusing error or some other problem, and I really can't do anything with them. So photos that are rated 3, I go through all of the photographs in an album, and I rate all the photos that I think I can do something with, something that could be interesting, as a 3. So they're either a 1 or a 3. And I go back through all of the photos that are rated 3, and then I try to determine, okay, do I like this photo more than just the 3 star? Is it something that I really think is worthwhile? Then I'll give that, I'll bump that up to a 4. And then I'll go through and only work with the 4-starred photos, or only work with, maybe I have a couple of 5-star photos that I only want to work with. This way I don't have to process all of the photos that I had just downloaded. I go through and I rate them based on what I think could be usable or could be workable, and then just select those few, which hopefully will be many few, and usually it's about 5 to 10% of the actual photos, and really work on those to make them very outstanding photographs based on color, other modifications that may need to be done. Okay, so this is the pinhole photo. It's pretty interesting. You can tell that you really can't see anything specific about anybody, except that you can see Chris because, of course, she is hiding behind the camera in the back there. And other than that, we really can't tell anything. We'll talk more about pinhole photos in the future. But one thing that you can tell is that it is really, really blurry, and it's really no good. And this is a result of a number of things, and we will talk more about that at a later date. So this is just a very basic overview of how to download photographs from your camera to your computer. But there's something else that a lot of this software can do that I think is really cool and certainly deserves mentioning. And so let me close this inspector HUD here and maybe make... Oh, so here you can see along the left side, let me just point out very, very quickly, you can see that I have image 2310 at the top. That was the original pinhole image. When I started making modifications to it, Aperture actually created a second one called version 2. And so now I can go back to the original one, the non-version 2, and I can see my original pinhole photo, or I can work with the photograph where I have made adjustments. And you can see that it gives me a nice little icon to tell me that I've actually made adjustments to that photograph. Yes?
Is there any difference between connecting your camera to your computer versus taking out the memory card and putting it either in a little USB reader or into the computer itself?
Good. So that's an excellent point. And so, yeah. I usually don't connect my camera to the computer, actually. Most of the time, another way to do this, certainly, is to actually take out the memory card that is in your camera, put it into an adapter such as this. So there's called a variety of things, memory card readers. They usually have something ridiculous like 301 different types of memory cards. You plug this in, it's also USB, you plug this in, and the computer recognizes it also as a camera, because what it does is it's reading the structure of the compact flash card or the memory card itself to determine what, you know, if it came from a camera or not. Then it's essentially the same. It's exactly the same. The same dialog box comes up, and I can show that now. I'll disconnect the camera, and I will take out the memory card. So the very important thing about this method that you must be careful of is that if the camera is still writing photos to the memory card, don't take it out of the camera, because you will most likely lose those photos in just about every camera. Some cameras are better than others. This Canon one, though, is very stupid about it. It doesn't tell you at all. It doesn't beep. It doesn't notify you in any way. If you don't notice that the light is still flashing when it's saying that it's writing data to the memory card, it doesn't tell you that it's still writing to the card and not to take out the memory card out of the camera. Some newer models, I think, might show you an alert or might beep or do something like that. Just be very, very careful, because you will likely lose all of that data. So I think we are going to see an example of why I don't like the MacBook Air, because the USB port is not big enough to support this fat little thing, so I can't actually show you. But rest assured that if that had actually worked, it would show me exactly the same thing that we had just seen. So there's a whole argument that could be made about how is the best way to download photographs. Many people swear by using the USB cord and never taking the memory card out of the camera for that reason that I just mentioned. You want to be absolutely sure that the camera is not writing data to it. Another thing is, well, you know, you're taking out this card many times, maybe you'll bend the pins. Frankly, the reason that I do it this way is that if I am taking a lot of photographs and I'm putting them on a large card, this is a 2 gigabyte card, to give a comparison, that's about half a DVD or about 3.5 CDs, for example, worth of data, then I can put another memory card into my camera and continue shooting while that data is being transferred on my computer. So it allows for a more continuous form of shooting, and I just have to be very careful not to take out the memory card when it is writing data. And I've actually never lost data that way, but I'm sure it's happened to somebody, so do be careful. But for this to work, you do need another memory card. This is a 1 gigabyte card. And actually, there is an excellent website. Let's see if I can find it. It's from a photographer that is called Rob Galbraith. I hope I'm pronouncing his name correctly. But he's taken this memory card idea and trying to find out which one is the fastest memory card. He's taken it to an extreme. He tests many memory cards in many different cameras to try to determine which one is the fastest one for a particular camera. And it's surprising the variation between these cards and between cameras. So what works best in my 20D may not work very well in your 30D, or may not work in your Nikon. Well, no, let me change that phrasing. It will work. It just may not be as quick in one camera as it is in another. So if you're going to shell out a lot of money for some fancy card that can write bits to it very, very quickly, you probably want to take a look at this database. And so I'll post the link to it online, but it's the CFSD Performance Database. And we can, by bringing down this drop-down, we can see that they have his variety of cameras. It looks like he has finally removed the 20D, but for a long time I used this to determine which one was best. Mostly you will only find SLRs and at that popular SLRs on this list. So if you have a non-SLR camera, you will most likely be out of luck. So let's pick one. Maybe we'll pick a 5D Mark II because that one has a big fancy new icon next to it. And now if you scroll down through this, he actually rates all of these CF cards based on how fast they are. So the one at the very top is the fastest one. It will write the most. The most number of photographs to the memory card in the fastest amount of time. And you generally want this when you're taking many, many photographs in succession. However, you really could go a little out of control here. You can see that. So this first one, SanDisk Extreme Ducati 8GB. Has a raw write speed of 32.6 megabytes per second, but the 4GB version of that same model only writes at 32.4 megabytes per second. And I guarantee you're not going to be able to tell the difference between those two write speeds. If you want to save however many hundreds of dollars it is and only get the 4GB one, don't worry about it. Don't let this be the Bible. Of CFSD performance, do take into account the cost of it. Basically, the ones that you see that are blue, so he has marked some of these as blue, those are the top 10% of the fastest SD cards or CF cards that are in this list. So if you pick any of them from that blue section, you pretty much can't go wrong. You'll get a fast card for your specific camera. So the reason that this is important is that you can then be able to write the most number of images to the camera and be able to continue taking photographs faster. Yes?
Realistically, though, if you're taking a 5 to 10 megabyte RAW file, are you going to notice any performance increase at all? I mean, like, you know, if you hold down the button and you're shooting in auto, it'll try to shake 3 or 4. If you're shooting in low quality, it can take like 20 in a row. Are you actually going to notice more out of that if you're dealing in high quality?
So the question is if you would actually be able to see a difference if you're shooting more. Yes, you would be able to. That only if certain conditions are met. So the camera has internal memory where it stores the raw photos for processing. So if you're taking JPEG photos, the camera takes the photo as a raw file format. Then there's some circuitry that converts it to a JPEG. And then it's stored in this, what's called a buffer, that's basically just like a memory card that exists inside of the camera. You can't modify or change it. And it's stored in that buffer as the camera continues to write data to the memory card. So if you have a faster card, it can flush out that buffer more quickly. So the only time that it becomes necessary to have a very fast card is if you have a camera that has maybe a relatively small buffer or takes monstrous images and fills up the buffer very, very quickly, and you need it to flush the buffer out so that you can keep taking photos. Because if the buffer is full, you can't keep taking photographs with your camera. Well, until enough space is flushed out of the buffer for you to be able to continue doing it. So, yes, it is important, especially with SLRs where it can take several frames per second, and especially if you're taking raw files or if you're taking photographs in the raw file format, they can be several tens of megabytes, maybe even 20 megabytes large, and can fill up your buffer very, very quickly. So this is why you would want a very fast compact flash card. And so also there's another reason why you want a fast flash card. You'd want to be able to download the images quickly to your computer. You don't want to be waiting around a long time. Though just about every modern compact flash card will download relatively quickly and pain-free from from the card to your machine. And in fact, let's see. So there's anecdotally, let's see. There is, I have something here. So many of these memory cards are actually fairly rugged. This is a blog post about a specific memory card where if you read the headline, it says, "Submerged camera holds functional memory card 2 years after an accident." And this is a relatively old blog post, but basically what had happened was someone had taken some photos with this digital camera, and they used, I guess, not necessarily any sort of special compact flash card as far as I know, but the camera was submerged underwater for whatever reason for several years. After they recovered the camera, presumably, I forget the details, but it was probably something like a lake accident, or a boating accident, or somebody drove their car into the lake, something like that. After they finally recovered it, they were able to take the memory card out of the camera, put it into their computer, and download the images that were contained on it. And a lot of these cards actually, like this one, for example, is a SanDisk Extreme. And this, they have these special model lines where they claim it can withstand all sorts of temperature gradations and all sorts of pressure and just all sorts of crazy things. I think they might have even tested it against certain high explosives and some stuff like that. But anyway, it's all marketing, though. A lot of these compact flash cards are durable. And even though they are relatively large compared to some of the smaller cards that we have now, SD cards in particular, which a lot of modern compact cameras are using, these compact flash cards, they just seem to be really durable and rugged. I love them. I think they're great. Yes?
Yeah, anecdotally, I found an SD card in a puddle in the wintertime, puddle of dirt, water, melts down, and wiped it off, put it in a camera, card reader, and I could see the photos perfectly.
Oh, interesting. Oh, that's great. Well, we will leave the ethical implications of looking at somebody else's photos from a pond or elsewhere. But yeah, no, that's
they were compromising photos.
They were compromising photos. That's awesome. We'll have to post them on the forum so that everybody can see them. No, I'm kidding.
Black boxes.
Yeah, little black boxes over the eyes and anything else that's less than PG or more than PG, whatever your preference is. So anyway, yeah, these compact flashcards are great. They really are durable. So even after all of our talk about backing up data and all of this other thing, for the most part, you really don't have to worry about it. Worry first about your camera and worry last about the memory card, especially if it's in the camera, because you will be, for the most part, you will be okay. So, well, I think that was like a 20-minute tangent from what I was trying to talk about back here in Aperture. Yeah, it all started when I realized that it was version 2 here. Okay, let me bring this window up. So there's another great thing that many SLRs are capable of doing, and that is the ability to connect your camera to a computer, not only download the photos that exist, but use your computer as a way to take photos from your camera. It's called tethering. And I have here, so Aperture allows tethering for a variety of cameras, and luckily mine is supported. The problem with tethering is that you really have to have a very specific combination of software and hardware to be able to tether your camera to it. So the Canon cameras, and this 20D specifically, came with the CD that has special Canon-specific tethering software, and I could put the DVD in or the CD into my computer, install the software, and be able to do this tethering. However, they never updated the software, so after several revisions of the Mac OS, I wasn't able to load the software anymore. It would always crash. So that's one example of this sort of obsolescence that can happen. But luckily, Aperture supports this, and I actually have selected tethering from a menu that's off-screen right now. And it basically just asks me where I want to store the files when I take it, if there's any metadata that I want to add, what file name I want to save it as, and I just will keep all the defaults and click Start Session. And this is where it's really cool. aperture seems to be somewhat basic in this tethering, but I've seen some very advanced pieces of software, especially when it comes from the manufacturers itself, themselves, where you can actually set camera settings on the from the computer to the camera. So you can specify exactly what modes you want to take and a variety of other things. In this case, aperture seems to just allow me to... Oh, no camera detected. I guess I need to plug it in. It's like that thing, you got to turn it on first. So anyway, let me just make sure I can get this to work. Go back to tethering. So aperture seems to not allow you to have that level of control, which is pretty interesting, I think, to have that level of control, not the fact that aperture does not have that ability. Okay, so you'll see that now here it tells me I have the tether dialog box up, and it tells me what kind of camera is connected. It tells me how many shots I've taken, the last shot, the version name, and it gives me a capture button. And if I click on this capture button, you'll notice that the camera immediately takes a photograph, and it will come up, and we'll get to see many of your pretty faces as I get to see it from up here. So I'll be at a lower and wider angle. So so you can tell me that it, or you can see that it gives a variety of information about the shot. Last shot, it gives me some information about the shot itself, and we'll go over all of these specific technical details. And this is cool, but this is not the true power of tethering, I think. I think the true power of tethering comes from you actually being at the camera, setting whatever settings you need to do and taking photographs, as long as you are tethered to this computer. So I can, you will need a relatively long USB cord unless you want to drag your laptop everywhere. I can actually come over here, take a photograph. It will download, and then I will immediately see the photo on the computer to be able to review it. And I can tell you that on this camera especially, this eensy-beensy tiny screen doesn't tell me very much, doesn't give me very much feedback about the photo that I had just taken. Oh, incidentally, for those of you that are relatively new to digital photography, do you know that when you're looking at a photo like this, that they call it chimping? You know why they call it chimping? So because when you're looking at a photo, you tend to go, ooh, 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 ooh. Okay, anyways. So don't chimp. We all do it, but try not to. And I hate it when I catch myself chimping. So I turn off the preview on the camera. So after I take a photograph, almost every camera will show you the photograph on the screen. And I think that is the primary cause of chimping, is because it comes up right away and then you're looking at it saying, oh yeah, that's awesome. So I turn it off, and then later I'll just sort of surreptitiously push the little play button and just make sure it looks good before moving on. But anyway, so this is where I think the true power of tethering comes in. You can see that I'm a wonderful photographer when I am tethering, but this is wonderful for a studio setup, or if you're taking photos in your home or apartment, or if you have some sort of a studio setup, you can look and get instant feedback on your computer about a photograph. You can not only see this information, but if I had some other things up, such as the histogram, which we go into great detail later on in the course, you can get some even more information about all of these photographs. Yes? How is it different from your camera when you actually get this information? It's the same information, it's just bigger. Yeah, it's just bigger.
You're saying it's better to look at it.
Yeah, I have a very hard time noticing how sharp a photograph is, even when I'm zooming in to it on this screen. But it becomes a lot more obvious, especially in the context through which I will be looking at the photograph. So here, I can actually bring up like a magnifying glass and take a look exactly to see how good or how poor the photograph or the quality of the photograph is. This is an excellent setup, especially if you are professional or semi-professional and you have a team of people working on a studio setup to get photographs taken. You may have one person or more reviewing the photographs, and you may have one photographer dealing with the actual camera settings and getting feedback from the person reviewing the photographs. And you don't even have to have a team. This is just useful for you. If you're taking a photograph of something in your home, it's just very, very useful to be able to have it there right away rather than constantly having to download the photos to your computer, reviewing them and saying, oh, I really should make a change, you know, moving it over 1 millimeter this way, doing some sort of mini change like that. And so I'm certainly an advocate of tethering. Yes? Well, I can control the camera from the computer, only that I can click capture. If the software was more advanced, which some pieces of software are, you can control the camera from the computer. And if that were possible in Aperture, I would very much enjoy that as well, because there are some situations where you just can't be near the camera in order to take a photograph. For example, if you're doing perhaps automotive photography where you're actually the camera's mounted outside externally in the vehicle and you're moving, you can't be outside as well. And you have to take the photograph remotely. And so doing this sort of remote tethering is useful in that case. And so this then is only so powerful for that capability, because sure, I could take a photo while the car is moving and review it, but I really can't make any changes if I need to. So if I was able to get this Canon software to work, then I would be able to make changes to the camera and be able, as the person is driving and I'm inside the car, try to actually make changes to the photograph. So tethering is very cool. Most likely, if you have a compact camera, you probably will not be able to do it unless it's very modern and a somewhat expensive compact camera. You'll have to just look to see what software is available for it. Yes?
Do you know any tethering setups that use like Bluetooth or a wireless setup, so you can have your laptop, say, here and then put your camera anywhere and then snap it from there?
So wireless tethering setups. I dreamt of that for a long time, years ago. I actually don't know. I haven't looked in a while. I'm sorry?
Canon has an attachment. So
they do have a Wi-Fi attachment, but does that actually allow for remote tethering over Wi-Fi? Do you know? Okay, so it seems possible that at least for certain Canon cameras, you can buy like a way too expensive Wi-Fi attachment where your camera suddenly can get online to a network. And it sounds, though I can't verify, that you can there remotely fire a camera that way. And that's certainly very, very cool. You could probably hack something crazy as well, but by giving yourself a really long USB cord, but there's probably a limit to that. Wireless is hopefully the wave of the future for these cameras. In fact, I can just rant a little bit. I don't know why some of these cameras don't have some more of this technology built in. Like, why don't they have Wi-Fi by now? Why do we need to actually connect USB cable or remove the memory card and connect it to our computer? I know there's some solutions. There are some cards, I think SD cards specifically, that are created and have a little Wi-Fi chip in them, so that when you take a photo and it's written to the memory card, the card actually transmits that photo wirelessly. That seems cool. That's a step in the right direction, but it seems more useful if it was actually built in to the camera. Okay, so that's my mini rant of the moment. And I do have many. So tethering is way, way cool. You can do a lot of things. So this was a lunar eclipse that had occurred back in 2004, I believe. This was the one that coincided with the Red Sox game. I think it was in the World Series. And everybody, I was actually living with a group of people, and everybody was watching the game, and I wanted to as well, because it's just, it's the Red Sox. It's a very social activity and it's wonderful. And so what I did was I used some tethering software, and this was tethering software made by Canon. And it actually had something built in called an intervalometer, where you can tell it a duration of photos. So I told it every 20 seconds or so, I forget exactly the interval, take a photograph. And every 20 seconds, it would take a photograph. And so eventually, I was able to stitch them together, and you see the result here. And you can't see it very well now because the contrast is low, but I actually had to move the camera, so you can see that there's sort of two locations where the camera was pointing. But this way, I was able to leave the computer outside in the snow and cold and just let it take the photos for me while I was inside. And so I was able to not only enjoy the game, but impress everybody that was living there by magically showing this photo just a few minutes later. So tethering is wonderful. It's very, very cool. This is, so every moon that you see is one photograph, and it was stitched in photograph later, in Photoshop later. So it is a composite of numerous images, and this is only one example. There are other stitches that I have, but I think it's pretty neat, especially if you have a better lens that can really zoom into the moon. But then, I mean, you get into a whole issue where if you take a photograph of the moon and it's taking up the entire frame, you have to actually track the moon as well, and so that's a whole different set of technology, like having motors on your tripod head to be able to follow the moon. That's a section of astrophotography that is really cool, but sort of beyond my means. Okay, moving on, because I'm ranting way too much. Raw processing, I don't want to get into too much detail. You saw me do a little bit of it with the photo, the pinhole photo that from last week. And we actually need to talk about Photoshop for a little bit. So for those of you that have used Photoshop in the past, that's good. But realize that for those of you that haven't used Photoshop, we will actually need to. Not initially, but in the future. And you can download Photoshop. Don't worry about buying it. You can download it as a registered student here. So let's see. Is this the one? Nope, this is the one. All right. I have it somewhere here. Okay, so if you go to, let me give you the URL, and I will, of course, post this on the course website. If you go to downloads, that's plural, downloads.fas.harvard.edu. Let me zoom in a little bit so you can see downloads.fas.harvard.edu. Hit return. It brings you to this page. You'll have to log in with your username and password. Do I remember it? Okay, this is going to be embarrassing because I have a very long password. Log in. Come on. The more my password, the length of the password is exposed, the more embarrassed I am. Okay, so after a while, it comes up. You know, so in this case, I'm on a Macintosh computer, so it automatically shows me that a list of Macintosh downloads. If you have a Windows machine, it will show you likewise Windows, or you can select your preferred platform on the right side here. There's a whole bunch of stuff that you can download and use for being a registered student here. But what we are interested in is Photoshop. And we can look, if we go down, it's in alphabetical order, you can download Photoshop here. But there is a small, slightly annoying aspect to this. And that is that, yes, you can download this and use it on your home computer, but you have to jump through some other hoops as well. So first start downloading Photoshop. It's massive, as you can see, it's about 900 megabytes. You'll also have to download two other pieces of software if you're going to use this from home. We'll go over this more in sections. You can ask questions on the forum, so I'm just going to gloss over it for now. You also need, in addition to Photoshop, the VPN client, which is at the very bottom, and also what's called the key server. And so you see that at the very bottom, key server restricts the number of software licenses that may be used simultaneously. So if I scroll up, you will find key server right here. So download.
You should download first the key server, install the key server, and then download Photoshop.
Right. So you should install the key server first. The reason I gave it in that order was because Photoshop is the largest, so it takes the longest. You might as well start downloading that first. VPN. You can download them in any order. Download them in any order you want. Those are the three important ones: key server, Photoshop, VPN. Install the key server first. It's very important. Install the key server first. Install the VPN, then install Photoshop. So the tricky part is that in order to complete the install of Photoshop, you must actually be VPN'd into Harvard. And I really don't want to go into too many details, but you basically open up the VPN software. If you're connected to the internet, you log into Harvard using the VPN, then the key server does its thing automatically. Don't worry about the key server once you've downloaded it and installed it. So after you VPN'd in, you can then install Photoshop. Now this, you only need the VPN server if you are off campus. Here on campus, you do not need the VPN. Did I say VPN server? I'm sorry, you do not need the VPN software if you are on campus. Only if you are off campus do you need the VPN software, but you do need the key server, and obviously you need Photoshop. You need the key server everywhere and Photoshop everywhere. So let's see. So I actually have Photoshop installed here, though it's difficult to show you because it shows on the other screen what happens when the key server comes up. Basically, when you click on Photoshop, as long as you've done it correctly, it says this is a keyed version of the software. You're allowed to use it, something like that. Be sure to quit it when you're done using it, something like that. We will go into more detail, like I said, in sections and on the forum if necessary. So Photoshop is obviously complex software. There is a joke that I once heard made about Photoshop. It's $600 software, and even pros only tend to use like $20, $30 worth of Photoshop. And that's certainly true. I cannot say that I am a Photoshop expert. I know my way around it, but there are many, many tricks that people devote literally their entire lives to figuring out Photoshop. And it's their profession. It's what they do. So we can only give some basic information or relatively basic information about Photoshop, but it's very important. And some of the tricks and tips that we use are very, very important. And so just very quickly about Photoshop, let's see. So Photoshop has a concept called layers. And what layers basically allow you to do is that you can, as it sounds, you can layer multiple images on top of one another. And a good example of this would be this image, as you know, where I have put multiple images on top of another. Each one is a separate layer. Think of it, you can think of it basically as this. So let's say you have your photograph, and I'll just use this piece of paper to represent a photograph for now. Imagine this is your photograph. You open it up in Photoshop, and it is exactly what it looks like. It's just a photograph. However, you have the option in Photoshop, so let me open, to make this a little bit more real, let me actually open a picture in Photoshop, the same one that I really should get more pictures on this machine, I suppose. So right here I have my photograph. It gives me some information about it. You can see that right now it's at 50% zoom. Now over here in the lower right-hand side, one of these palettes is called the layers palettes. I can add multiple layers to it. So notice what happens if I click on this button that's way down here. Let me zoom in. You can see that along the bottom of the palette there's a variety of icons. This one that looks like a little document or a little flipping pages, that's a new layer that will allow you to add a new layer. Let me add it. So now I have layer one. Now, you don't actually see anything different about the photograph, but what's important, you can think of it as, if this is my photograph, I have now put a layer of transparency, so, you know, like a transparent sheet on top of this. So now I can make whatever modifications I want to that transparent layer, and it will appear as though I'm making the changes to the photograph, but I am only making the changes to that one layer. So let me really defile my photograph here and put a little smiley face in the sun. Okay, so now if I were to save this, you would probably think I was crazy or funny, but hopefully both. But I put this on the layer, and the reason that, or the way that you can tell is that this layer, layer one, was selected. You can see that it is highlighted, so that is the layer that I am modifying. Notice that to the left of that layer, there's a little eye. If you click on that eye, it hides or shows the layer, depending on whether or not the eye is visible. So take a look at first at the sun. I'm going to do this a couple times, and then take a look at the eye. So when I click on the eye, you notice that the smiley face disappears. That's because I have essentially removed that transparency from the compilation of images. If I add that transparency back on, then we see that modification. So this is a wonderful way, if we go back to this notion of destructive and non-destructive editing, this is a wonderful way of making changes to your photograph without actually making changes to the photograph. You can make changes to a variety of layers. You can add more than one layer. You can add many, many layers, make many changes, and take out or add in new layers as you please. So hopefully this is review for many of you, but this is very, very important concept about Photoshop, and it's one of the many powerful features about it. So just very basically, let's just go over some of the stuff about Photoshop. So we have along this left side here a toolbar with a variety of tools. We have a variety of marquee tools. They're called marquee tools because we can then select certain aspects of a photograph. So there's a rectangular marquee. I can use a lasso to make a separate marquee. We have some other things like this, a crop tool, which, as you know, you want to crop something if you want to change its aspect ratio or if you want to just select a smaller portion of it. So you may recognize this cropped version may look more familiar to you as being off of the course website, for example. And you can see that one of the things that we've changed, not only is it smaller, obviously, but another thing that's important is that the aspect ratio is changed. The aspect ratio is just basically a funky word for the ratio of the width to the height. So normally, just about every photograph that you take, especially with SLRs, will have a typical aspect ratio of 3:2. So that means for every 3 pixels that you have wide, you have 2 pixels down. After I cropped it in that way, I've changed the aspect ratio to be a lot narrower. So this is probably more like 4:1 or something like that. I would have to calculate it by looking at the image size. So cropping is a pretty useful thing to do. I don't want to go over all of these tools, but you have some things here like the brush tool, which I just used to brush the little smiley face on the sun. You can use this spot healing brush tool so you can fix blemishes on a face of a person, for example, in a portrait. There's upsides and downsides to all of these tools. There's a dodge and burn tool. So those of you that are familiar with actually printing your own photos using film, you probably know what dodge and burn is, where you can make sections of the photograph darker or lighter depending on whether you want to burn it or dodge it. You can also add some pretty ridiculous text, and there's a variety of things that exist here. We'll go over a lot of this stuff. Well, not a lot, but we'll go over some of this stuff in some of the future software lectures. One of the other important things that I want to mention is image size. So when you actually want to resize an image, you want to do an image size. And so just about every piece of software that you use to organize or download your photos should allow you to change an image size. I certainly don't think you need to open up Photoshop because it takes forever and load an image to change its size. But this really is worth noting that, let me make it original. Okay, so here you can see that the original image size here is 1202 pixels wide by 800 pixels high. So this actually is already a cropped and resized version of this photograph that I'm using as wallpaper because my screen happens to be 1200 by 800 pixels. The two, I can't really explain. It seems like a silly thing to leave. So generally what you want to do when you're resizing an image is you want to resize the image while keeping the aspect ratio the same. If you don't keep the aspect ratio the same, you're going to do something funny like scrunch it or squish it or make it taller or do something like that. You'll alter the appearance of the people in it for better or for worse. So maybe you do want to squish it if you have... If your friends would like to look, you know, 5 or 10 pounds thinner, but maybe, you know, if you go the wrong way, you could get on their bad side. So usually what you want to look for is something similar to this option here, constrain proportions. This means that when you are making a modification to the image size, it will not let you modify the aspect ratio. So the whole point of this exercise is that when you download a photograph off of your camera, it's probably going to be some number of megapixels large, maybe 8 megapixels, for example. And that's generally too large to send via email or over the internet. The reason that you don't want to do this is because maybe you're sending it to your parents, for example. You're sending a photograph that you're very proud of to your parents. Maybe they're not as well versed as you are in using a computer. So you want to make sure that that photograph is not absolutely monstrous, and they only see, you know, a small portion of the photograph because the rest of it is off screen. So other reasons include that you really want to decrease the size the file size of the photograph so that you don't flood somebody's inbox with some images. So you'll notice that here it tells me that it's 2.75 megapixels. It's basically multiplying. It's telling me how many pixels there are. You can use that basically as a way of determining how much smaller you're making it. So take a look at the pixel dimensions. Let's say I make it 600 pixels wide by, in this case, you notice that it changed the height for me as well to maintain the aspect ratio. I have now changed it to 700K rather than 2.75. So rather than 2.75 megapixels large. And so the reason that you want to, like I said, to make this smaller is to make it easier to send. It's, if a photo is smaller, it's a lot easier to send over email. But the other reason is that if you keep the original file to yourself, you can keep the original size, unmodified file on your computer and only send a modified version, whether it's made smaller or some other modification, to someone else, you can always prove that you are the original photographer of that version. Because if someone tries to steal your photograph, for example, you can say, oh, you've stolen my photograph. They say, oh, you know, they can counter, oh, no, you have no proof of that. You can say, well, yes, I have the raw file. I can prove that I took this photograph and you did not. It's just a way of, one of the things that I do to protect myself from people stealing photographs, for example. We'll go into all of that stuff. I have a whole rant and rave about that as well later. So anyway, generally a good size, you might want to make the width no larger than 1,000. Maybe for email, even 500, 600 would be good. It's really this sliding scale. It depends on how large their screen is, how large their mailbox is, or how large their mail program is on their screen. Like I said, 500 to 1,000 width by whatever height tends to be pretty good in my book. So, okay, thank you for your patience as I went over. Next week, we get into some of the really fun stuff. See you then.